Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are. Welcome to another Intensive Care Hotline and intensivecareathome.com live stream. The title of this live stream is Ask Me Anything, Life Support, ICU Decisions, Tracheostomy, Intensive Care at Home, anything related to those topics for families in intensive care. I'm here to answer your questions. I also want to welcome our viewers on replay. Anyone who's here on the live stream, I welcome, of course. Anyone that's viewing this on replay, I welcome as well, of course. These live streams are your opportunity to talk to me live here, ask your questions to me directly, and get an answer straight away. My name is Patrick Hotzel, and I'm the host of the show here. What makes me qualified to host a show for families in intensive care, where you can ask anything, life support, ICU decisions, tracheostomy, intensive care at home. I'm a critical care nurse by background, having worked in critical care nursing for over 25 years in three different countries, where I worked as a nurse manager for over 5 years in intensive care. And I've been consulting and advocating for families in intensive care here at intensivecarehotline.com since 2013. And I can very confidently say that we have saved many lives for our clients in intensive care. And you can verify that on our testimonial section at intensivecarehotline.com. And you can verify it on our intensivecarehotline.com podcast section, where we have done client interviews. I'm also the founder and managing director of intensivecareathome.com. And you can find more information at intensivecareathome.com. With intensive care at home, we are sending our team of critical care nurses into the home to provide a genuine alternative to a long-term stay in intensive care for long-term ventilated adults and children with tracheostomies, but also for adults and children with tracheostomies without ventilation, also BiPAP, CPAP ventilation without tracheostomy, copper cyst management at home, patch tube, nasogastric tube management, home TPN, home IV fluids, home IV potassium infusions, home IV magnesium infusions, and home IV antibiotics. That includes central line, peak line, Hickman's line, and port management at home. With intensive care at home, we are currently operating all around Australia in all major capital cities, as well as all regional and rural areas. We're also providing level 2 and level 3 NDIS support coordination with intensive care at home. Now, without further ado, if you have any questions, please type them into the chat pad or connect with me live here on the StreamYard link. I posted the StreamYard link into the chat pad and you can talk to me live here directly. Now, if there are no questions right away, I will read out questions that have come in during the week or comments that have come in during the week, including testimonials. Let's start with a testimonial that came in this week. Just give me 1 second. So there's a testimony coming in this week. Said, "Hi, Patrick. I hope you're well. I thought you might be interested in this article," and I come to that article later. But this former client of ours sent me an article about organ donation in the US, but I'll talk about that in a minute. She goes on in the testimonial to say, "My sister is alive and well. She has gone from not being able to walk at all to taking regular walks, and from not being able to talk, having full conversations. I sensed something was very wrong early on, and I had no idea how to change the situation. I don't know what I would have done without your daily support and guidance. It was invaluable. Even though I have a strong medical background, and I know this former client of ours is a medical code upper background, it would have been difficult to understand all the inner workings of the ICU by myself. You taught me how to read all the important instruments that were keeping my sister alive. It was very apparent her care and my family were being manipulated in order to get the outcome the ICU wanted. You and your staff gave me the courage and moral support to stand up to the doctors in ICU who literally harassed and tried to intimidate me on a daily basis to make my sister a DNR. DNR stands for do not resuscitate, right? This started only a few days in before her brain even had a chance to heal. I found the doctors would stop at nothing to attempt to get a DNR from me, even pitting my family against me since I was the only holdout of many people. It was after my sister's discharge I found out that the nurse's station had her driver's license the entire time. She was listed as an organ donor. No wonder they wanted to make a DNR and let her die. I don't know what I would have done without your invaluable guidance and that of your staff. No doubt you helped save my sister's life. I can never thank you enough." Now, I do, and this is from Cassidy, and I vividly remember working with Cassidy, might have been about 12 or 18 months ago now, where her sister was in ICU. I think she went in there with a cardiac arrest, you know, query hypoxic brain injury, and the ICU was so adamant to letting her sister die, right? And we said, no, it's way too early. And, you know, she can't come off the ventilator, right? She needs to, you know, have a tracheostomy. If she can come off the ventilator, she needs to go into rehabilitation. Now, I'm just looking through Cassidy's file and find out whether she had a tracheostomy or not. I can't remember. I have to admit that. But what I do remember is that the ICU team was extremely negative, and also her, you know, Cassidy's own family was very negative about her sister's condition, and that it might have been, quote unquote, in the best interest of her sister to let her die. And you know, I mean, what do I always say here? You know, what's the urgency to kill someone? Where is the urgency to kill someone? Where's the rush? Right? Where's the rush to kill someone? Please answer that. You know, so I'm just looking back through Cassidy's file and trying to find out whether she had a life-threatening hemorrhage, right? A brain hemorrhage. And now she's walking and talking again. Right? So, and it's, you know, it's unbelievable to going from ICU saying, oh, well, it's in the best interest of her to die and she should just die, to now going back to normal. You know, and I'm just looking through her file. She had also a cardiac arrest and she brought back within 5 minutes. You know, and then also says in one of her emails there from a while ago when we were working with her, I just had a call from a doctor in ICU who is once again doubling down on me to make my sister a DNR. Let me say that again. I just had a call from the ICU doctor who is once again doubling down on me to make my sister a DNR. right? She said she sees no improvement since she came on, and that's after about 5 or 6 days. And here we are 18 months later, and Cassidy's sister is back to walking and talking. So you have to question the clinical judgment of the ICU team here. And I know you watching, you're probably in a similar situation, right? And then she continues in her email there. She's pressuring me, what would my sister want? And then I encounter, this is not about what you want. This is about your sister's quality of life and could she live with it? I told the doctor to stop with the fear tactic once again. I'm well aware I need time to make an informed decision. She clearly doesn't like it that I'm not taking her word for it. She's worried my sister will be institutionalized for the rest of her life. Well, and here we are 18 months later. She's not institutionalized. She's at home walking and talking. Would I allow a DNR? I said no. Then on with the guilt trip. I'm now getting texts from my other family members pressuring me. This is today's update from the doctor. So my sister developed blood clots in her arms and they have her on anticoagulants, Lovenox. She now has a bleed which they haven't located. They're giving her blood today. They're now doing a CT scan. Her white cell count had improved somewhat, down to 22,000 now, it's at 36,000. She did have a previous UTI, which I understand cleared up. They have not been able to find the source of this infection. Could it still be from the encephalitis? So she had encephalitis where, you know, the ICU said she will never recover and she will die. Never, ever let common sense take away from you. Never, ever let common sense take away from you. Because ICU is trying to tell you, don't use common sense. Is it, let me ask you this, is it common sense to push you towards agreeing to your family member dying? Is that common sense? I argue no, but that's what ICUs are trying to do. They're trying to take common sense away from you. Never, ever let ICU take away common sense from you. So then she continues that the ICU doctor told me her role is to tell me what's happening and my role is to do what my sister would want. And I told her I'm doing research and I need time to make a reasonable informed decision. And I won't be pressured, so I suggest you stop. It's been really bad since the day after my sister had the cardiac arrest. I spoke with a cardiologist 3 days ago and her heart is back to baseline. He feels she's at minimal risk for another cardiac event and feels like she was doing well overall. Her left ventricular ejection fraction is back to 50%. She was diagnosed with a stress-induced cardiomyopathy, which I know can heal in a few weeks. We're also told she's in heart failure. That is no longer true. Of course, they didn't voluntarily let us know these things. I asked. This ICU doctor also told me her blood pressure was low today. I said, I'm aware you have her on 5 high blood pressure meds. She added 2 more yesterday that my sister had been taking at home. The RN said the goal was to keep her blood pressure below 150 millimeter per mercury systolic. They restarted spironolactone 25 milligrams yesterday, also and on amlodipine 10 milligrams, hydralazine 25 milligrams every 8 hours, losartan 25 milligrams daily, metoprolol 50 milligrams every 6 hours. As you can see on the pictures I sent you, her blood pressure was quite low last night. The bells chimed and nurse had to give her something to bring back up. All these blood pressure meds make no sense to me. So, this is such a good example here to see what happens if you don't give up. You know, and thank you, Cassidy, for sharing this with us because this is such a, you know, good example that if you don't give up, if you keep fighting, that's what happens. People do recover. Think about it. You must think logically. 70 to 90% of ICU patients survive. That means the odds are in your loved one's favor. So why would anyone in their right mind not advocate when the odds are in your loved one's favor? Right? So And again, I'm going back to my emails from when we were working with these countries. As the ICF doctor said, she doesn't think my sister can have a good recovery, would likely be institutionalized for the rest of her life. So you have to question the clinical judgment of ICU teams at times. Right? So, no ventilator changes on anti-seizure medication such as Keppra, 1250 milligrams twice a day or every 12 hours, and valproic acid, 500 milligrams every 8 hours, on ketamine, 20, last dose on acyclovir, started on the 10th, third day, propofol for sedation continuously, gave her fentanyl for spontaneous breathing trial and giving fentanyl PRN. She was able to breathe on her own for 1.5 hours yesterday, has been up to 3 hours previously, and as low as 5 and 10 minutes, not consistent. So as you can see, the picture here is pretty negative. And, you know, the picture was very negative there. But that doesn't mean someone's going to die because the picture is negative. That doesn't mean someone can't recover because the picture is negative. Right? So I'm just scrolling back to other emails that I had from the client at the time to really paint the picture for you so that you understand what's happened. Has been in ICU for 10 days now, and they're really wanting to put her in quote unquote comfort care and make her DNR. That's after 10 days. She had infection from shingles into the brain, has encephalitis, and they let her go into cardiac arrest this past Monday and brought her back. And now they're painting this big picture to my family that her life will look very grim if they try to rescue her. And now it's just in her quote unquote best interest to let her go. Now that was, I'll tell you exactly when that was. That was in October 2024. Here we are, August 2025. So about 10 months later, this lady is walking and talking. Now, where else? What else is she saying? That is my initial talk with her. Then I advise her to get access to medical records, of course, which is always inevitable in situations like that. And bear in mind, this lady is 68 or 69 years of age, not very old. You know. Then what's she saying? And also, what is important here, yes. It's very important for you to understand, especially for our families in the United States. You know, there was a documentary on NBC a couple of years ago, where NBC has done some research that some hospitals are actually being incentivized by health insurances to issue DNRs and to let patients die prematurely because that's less cost for the health insurances. So, you know, you have to look at all these issues from a very bigger picture, and you mustn't assume anything. You must apply scrutiny, and you know you can never take life for granted, never. You know, and if your gut's telling you something's not right, your gut never lies. Right? If your gut's telling you that something's not right, something's not right. Right? So. That's just another success story here, you know, out of many. We're adding success story after success story. Now, what this lady has also done is she sent me an article that I want to read out. And the article is, because she was worried at the time that they would want to make her sister DNR, let her die to harvest organs. Now she sends me a great article. It says, Health and Human Services in the US find systemic disregard for sanctity of life in organ transplant system. Obviously, this is relevant for our viewers in the United States. Secretary Kennedy threatens closure of deficient organ procurement organization. Washington, July 21st, 2025. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, under the leadership of Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., today announced a major initiative to begin reforming the organ transplant system following an investigation by its Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, that revealed disturbing practices by a major organ procurement organization. Our findings show that hospitals allowed the organ procurement process to begin when patients showed signs of life, and this is horrifying, Secretary Kennedy said. The organ procurement organizations that coordinate access to transplants will be held accountable. The entire system must be fixed to ensure that every potential donor's life is threatened with the sanctity it deserves. HRSA directed the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network, OPTN, to reopen a disturbing case involving potentially preventable harm to a neurologically injured patient by the federally funded Organ Procurement Organization, OPO, serving Kentucky, Southwest Ohio, and part of West Virginia. Under the Biden administration, the OPTN's Membership and Professional Standards Committee closed the same case without action. Under Secretary Kennedy's leadership, HRSA demanded a thorough independent review of the OPO's conduct and the treatment of vulnerable patients under its care. HRSA's independent investigation revealed clear negligence after the previous OPTN board of directors claimed to find no major concerns in their internal review. HRSA examined 351 cases where organ donation was authorized, but ultimately not completed. It found, number one, 103 cases, 29.3%, showed concerning features, including 73 patients with neurological signs incompatible with organ donation. Let me repeat that again. 103 cases, that's 29.3%, showed concerning features, including 73 patients with neurological signs incompatible with organ donation. At least 28 patients may not have been deceased at the time organ procurement was initiated, raising serious ethical and legal questions. Let me repeat that. At least 28 patients may not have been deceased at the time organ procurement was initiated, raising serious ethical and legal questions. Next. Evidence pointed to poor neurological assessments, lack of coordination with medical teams, questionable consent practices, and misclassification of causes of death, particularly in overdose cases. Next, vulnerabilities were highest in smaller and rural hospitals, indicating systemic gaps in oversight and accountability. In response to these findings, HRSA has mandated strict corrective actions for the OPO and system-level changes to safeguard potential organ donors nationally. The OPO must conduct a full root cause analysis of its failure to follow internal protocols, including non-compliance with the 5-minute observation rule after the patient's death, and develop clear, enforceable policies to define donor eligibility criteria. Additionally, it must adopt a formal procedure allowing any staff member to hold the donation process if patient safety concerns arise. Secretary Kennedy will decertify the OPO if it fails to comply with these corrective action requirements. HRSA also took action to make sure that patients across the country will be safer when donating organs by directing the OPTN to improve safeguards and monitoring at the national level. Under HRSA's directive, data about any safety-related stoppages of organ donation called for by families, hospitals, or OPO staff must be reported to regulators, and the OPTN must update policies to strengthen organ procurement safety and provide accurate, complete information about the donation process to families and hospitals. What are we all about here at Intensive Care Hotline? We're all about transparency. These findings from HHS confirm what the Trump administration has long warned. Entrenched bureaucracies, outdated systems, and reckless disregard for human life have failed to protect our most vulnerable citizens. Let me repeat this. These findings from HHS confirm what the Trump administration has long warned. Entrenched bureaucracies, outdated systems, and reckless disregard for human life have failed to protect our most vulnerable citizens. Under Secretary Kennedy's leadership, HHS is restoring integrity and transparency to organ procurement and transplant policy by putting patients' lives first. These reforms are essential to restoring trust, ensuring informed consent, and protecting the rights and dignity of prospective donors and their families. HHS recognizes House Committee on Energy and Commerce Chairman Brett Guthrie's bipartisan work to improve the organ transplant system and looks forward to working with him and other issue area champions in Congress to deliver reforms. So what have we been saying here at intensivecarehotline.com since 2013, that obviously the organ donor process might be flawed in some countries, right? And clearly this is a sign that in the US, some investigations have taken place and some warnings have been issued as part of it, and the process is being changed. And that is a very good thing. That is a very good thing, and it makes a lot of sense to apply scrutiny here. Now, interestingly enough, this also comes after I talked about the difference between, just give me one second. I made a quick tip video in the last 2 weeks or so, where I talked about the difference between DCD organ donation and brain death organ donation. I can't remember that I spoke about on this show about it in much detail, but I definitely made a quick tip video about it. But I can't remember whether I spoke about it on this in the live show here. If someone can remind me, please let me know. But let's just quickly talk about it again, because I think it ties right in with our topic today. What's the difference between DCD and brain death organ donation in ICU? So if your loved one is in ICU and doctors are talking about organ donation, you need to understand the critical difference between DCD donation after circulatory death and brain death organ donation. ICU teams often push families towards organ donation decisions without giving you the full picture. That's why we're here. To make sure you make informed decisions, have peace of mind, control, power, influence, even if you're not a doctor or a nurse in intensive care, so that your loved one gets best care and treatment always. And all we base this on here is on facts, not pressure. So let's break it down. Brain death organ donation, what it really means. Brain death is a legal definition of death, but it's controversial, or it can be perceived as controversial. When someone is declared brain dead, their brain has permanently stopped functioning, but their heart is still beating, usually with the help of a ventilator. What doctors often won't tell you is this: even though your loved one is declared quote unquote dead, and they may look alive, this confuses many families. So why is this important? Because organs from someone who is brain dead are well perfused with oxygenated blood, meaning they're in ideal condition for organ transplantation. That's why there's often pressure to declare brain death quickly, to retrieve the organs before deterioration. Organs that can be donated in brain death are heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, pancreas, and intestines. Let's look at DCD, donation after circulatory death, what they won't tell you. In DCD, your loved one is not brain dead. Instead, the family agrees to withdraw life support and the medical team waits for the heart to stop beating. After a 2 to 5 minute no-touch period, death is declared based on circulatory criteria. This is called controlled DCD and is used when the patient has a devastating brain injury or terminal condition, but doesn't meet brain death criteria. Here's the catch. Because the organs are not getting oxygen during the dying process, there's a risk of damage from warm ischemia, a lack of blood flow that starts when the heart stops. Not only a lack of blood flow, but also a lack of oxygen. Organs typically donated in DCD, kidneys, liver, lungs, sometimes, and pancreas occasionally. The heart can rarely be donated after DCD, only in very specialized cases. So let's look at donation. Let's look at the summary, DCD versus brain death donation in simpler terms. So when is, let's look at the criteria in brain death organ donation and in death by circulatory death organ donation after circulatory death donation. So criteria, declared death by neurological criteria, brain function stops for brain death organ donation. In DCD organ donation, it's circulatory criteria, the heart stops beating. Next, ventilator support. In brain death organ donation, it's yes until organs are retrieved. In DCD organ donation, it's life support is withdrawn first, then death occurs. Next, organ perfusion. Organs remain in brain death organ donation, organs remain perfused and oxygenated. In DCD organ donation, perfusion stops, risking organ damage. Next, common organs donated. In brain death organ donation, heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, pancreas, and intestines. In DCD, it's kidneys, liver, lungs, it's limited. Now, next, look at the criteria of time to retrieval. In brain death organ donation, it's immediate after death is declared. In DCD organ donation, it's delayed due to withdrawal, a waiting period, and death. The bottom line here is this: do not be pressured. Get informed instead. Whether doctors are talking about brain death or DCD, you have the right to question, pause, and get a second opinion. Don't let them push you into making a rushed decision. We've seen it too many times, families being told that there is quote unquote no hope when the loved one would have lived or recovered if only given more time and support. If you need help understanding your rights, asking for time, organizing second opinions, exploring home care with a tracheostomy and ventilator, you know, reach out to us here at intensivecarehotline.com or at intensivecareathome.com. So then, if you have any questions, type them into the chat pad or connect with me live here on the StreamYard link. I posted the StreamYard link into the chat pad. So let's look at other questions that have come in during the week. No, that one I had already covered. Let's look at this. Sorry, I've just got to look at my questions that have come in during the week that I can get to the next one. Now, here is a good one. Where is it? Here it is. Sorry, it's so blunt, but I'm seriously ill. But it's seriously ill with this hospital. When someone walks into the ER, gets an IV, and when the medicine they put into those wins, throws him into cardiac arrest, he codes, they bring him back, intubate him, no real reason other than at this hospital. It seems that what this quote unquote puts out in quote, training personnel do. This is actually from an email from George. So let's just quickly read this email again. or let's look at this email in more detail so that I can answer this. So, George, when someone comes into the ER and, you know, is getting an IV drip, you know, you never know what's in there, of course. By the same token, the other question that I have for you here is what got your family member into the ER in the first place? You know? And it sounds to me like you're describing a very serious concern about the hospital standards of care. Specifically, your family member walked into ER, was given IV medication, then went into cardiac arrest, was resuscitated and intubated without what he sees as a clear medical reason. Now, and you're suggesting this may be part of a troubling pattern at that hospital, potentially inexperienced or inadequately supervised staff, you know. And like I always say, the biggest challenge for families in intensive care is simply that they don't know what they don't know. You know, that they don't know what they don't know. Don't know what to look for. They don't know what questions to ask. They don't know their rights, and they don't know how to manage doctors and nurses in intensive care. You know, and it's, of course, a shocking experience that raises serious questions about hospital standards of care. So if a patient walks into ER on their own and they were given an IV drip, but the medication they received triggered the cardiac arrest, the patient coded, was resuscitated, and then without any clear or justified medical reason was intubated and placed on a ventilator. My first question here, George, is do you have access to the medical records, right? Maybe your family member was coming into the ER already on the brink of a cardiac arrest, right? I've seen that in my decades worth of working in ICU. Right. So it's easy to jump to conclusions, and while you're probably right in sort of being concerned about training standards in this hospital, there's still a chance that, you know, your family member might have been at the brink of a cardiac arrest. But from what you're describing, it might not have been an isolated case in this hospital. Maybe you have information that you haven't shared, you know. If training personnel are performing high-risk interventions as routine practice, even when they may not be medically warranted. I mean, that would be unacceptable. However, one thing that I always say is focus on what you can control, not what you can't control. What you can control in a situation like this is get access to the medical records. Find out what exactly happened and get a second opinion, which is what we do here at intensivecarehotline.com. You know, if you and I were to get on a call with the doctors, we'll find out very quickly what's happened. Right? Request a full explanation of what's happened and demand senior oversight. Right? Especially when it comes to intubation, mechanical ventilation, ICU admission, cardiac arrest. You know, your family member is probably on inotropes or vasopressors, or at least required them for a period of time, right? Find out what ventilator settings your family member is on. Find out what they've done about the cardiac arrest. Has your family member had an ultrasound of the heart? Has your family member had an angiogram or an angioplasty as part of the diagnostic screening, right? Has your family member sustained a hypoxic brain injury? Has a CT scan of the brain been done? Has an MRI scan of the brain been done? Has an EEG of the brain been done? If your family member had a cardiac arrest, was your family member in cooling therapy, or is your family member still in cooling therapy? Ask for the credentials of the team treating him or her. You haven't identified, but I think you did say him. You know, and maybe report this episode to your local department of health. Because it sounds to me like you have some serious concerns here. Serious concerns. So, here is another email from a subscriber that came in this week, where the subscriber says, just give me 1 second. The subscriber says, feeling the ICU has already given up on my brother, who was just recently admitted with a traumatic brain injury. And I'm very sorry that you feel that way. And unfortunately, you're not alone in those situations. Many families in ICU notice that, especially after severe diagnosis, such as a traumatic brain injury, also known as a TBI, the medical team's focus can quickly shift from aggressive treatment to discussions about quote-unquote quality of life and withdrawal of treatment, right? And what's important here is when ICU teams talk about quote-unquote quality of life, they're talking about a perception, and many perceptions are not reality, right? Keep that in mind. They're trying to create a narrative that helps them to withdraw treatment and care and let your brother die. Right? Think about that. Think about that. They would let your brother die, but you need to fight for it. Remember when I talked about the case of the testimonial that I read out earlier, the ICU said, you know, that Cassidy's sister will not survive, and if she will survive, she won't have any quality of life. And here we are, not even 10 months later, she's walking and talking back home. So a few things you need to keep in mind and act on right now. Watch for subtle sign that they have given up. They talk more about prognosis and quote unquote futility than about treatment options. Now, what's futility? I'm glad you've asked. Futility is, or futile is a term that means of no perceived benefit, right? Now, the medical community wants to make you believe it's of no benefit, but I say it's of no perceived benefit. There's a difference. So never, you know, and shut those discussions down. You know, my advice is just shut those discussions down. Just let them know that you only want to talk about treatment options. That's all you want to talk about. Next. They suggest DNR or DNI orders early, sometimes within hours or days. What's DNR? DNR stands for do not resuscitate, i.e. they suggest to not resuscitate your brother in case his heart stops. What's DNI? DNI is do not intubate. That means if your brother stops breathing, they wouldn't intubate him with a breathing tube and mechanically ventilate him and preserve his life. Also, another term for DNR is sometimes NFR, which stands for not for resuscitation. It's synonym to DNR. Next, they seem to reduce tests, monitoring or therapy intensity without clear explanation. Now, but you need to have the eye for that. Now, the devil is in the detail. You need an ICU expert on your team to even spot those issues, right? Because you wouldn't even know what to ask for, right? If they're not talking about diagnostics, i.e. CT scans, MRI scans, ultrasounds, you know, x-rays, and the list goes on. If they're not talking about that, and they're talking more about a negative prognosis, you need to counteract that. ICUs are very good at creating a negative narrative, right? Don't let them do that. Create your own positive narrative. See what happens. Right? Because the longer your loved one is alive, I mean, how many times have you heard in ICU, oh, your loved one won't survive? You know, when every day they're alive, every day they're living, you have to question the clinical judgment of the ICU team. You know, because they're trying to potentially mislead you. Next, they stop talking about possible rehabilitation or next steps and instead steer the conversation towards quote unquote comfort care or end of life care. Right? Always keep the conversation about positive things. Always. Right? Always talk about what the next steps are towards a positive outcome. And always keep in mind that 70 to 90% of intensive care patients survive. So the odds are in your family member's favor. Right? Next, keep the conversation in the treatment and recovery frame. Once again, do not talk about end of life if you don't want to talk about end of life. Talk about life. Talk about moving forward. Right? Keep the conversation positive. If they say your brother won't recover, respond with something like, I understand you have concerns about prognosis, but right now we want full treatment and all options explored. Demand specific updates and plans. Ask daily, what is today's plan to improve his condition? What are the short-term and long-term treatment goals? Which specialists have seen him today? What rehabilitation or neurostimulation options are being considered? Next, get a second opinion early. With TBI, traumatic brain injury, outcomes can improve drastically over months, not days. And early withdrawal of treatment can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you feel resistance from the current team, you can request a formal neuro consult if not already done. Involve hospital administration or patient advocacy services like here, what we do at intensivecarehotline.com. If possible, consider transfer to a neurotrauma specialty center. Right? We can give you a second opinion here, right? You need access to medical records and we can give you a second opinion just simply by talking to doctors and nurses directly. You will see that once I speak to doctors and nurses directly with you on your behalf, you will see the dynamics will change in your favor pretty quickly, because then the ICU team will understand that you have someone on your team that understands intensive care inside out, just like you do, just like they do, right? Next, document everything. Write down what they say each day. This not only keeps the team accountable, but helps you track inconsistencies and ensures nothing gets quietly dropped. Right. So, never ever give up and never let common sense or your intuition dissuade you from what's right. Right? Because if you let common sense or what's right dissuade you, or listen to your gut, if your gut's telling you something's not right, your gut is probably right. Right? So here's how you can go about it to make it crystal clear to the ICU team that you expect full treatment for your brother and that you're watching the situation closely. You can say, we appreciate the work you're doing for my brother and we want to be completely clear about our expectations moving forward. Our goal is full treatment and every possible chance for recovery. We are not discussing withdrawal of treatment, DNR, or comfort care at this stage. We know that with traumatic brain injuries, recovery can take many months and early prognosis are often inaccurate. We want you to proceed on that basis. From now on, we'd like daily updates that include today's treatment plan, short-term and long-term goals for his recovery, any changes in medications, interventions, or monitoring, and why. What rehabilitation, neurostimulation, or other recovery-focused therapies are being considered now or in the near future? We also want access to all medical records. We also want all specialists relevant to his condition, including neurotrauma and rehabilitation teams, consulted as soon as possible. Please document in his medical records that the family's current wishes are full treatment and no limitations of care and treatment unless we specifically change that decision. We are committed to being active participants in his care plan, and we'll be asking these questions every day to ensure the best possible outcome for him. If you walk in with this and either read it or hand to them a printed copy to put in his chart, you shift the dynamics instantly. It lets them know you understand your rights, you know TBI recovery timelines, and you're not going to let them quietly move towards giving up. Well, and some hospitals are not even quietly moving towards giving up, they are moving overtly to giving up. Right? And also keep in mind, you know, if ICUs are giving up prematurely and want you to move towards end of life, you know, again, that could be perceived as murder or euthanasia. And that's what I'm saying. Never, ever let common sense dissuade you from what's right. Never, ever. You know. So. Okay, so let's look at one more question before we wrap this up. For today. I've an email. Isabella says, I have a friend, early 70s, in ICU, currently ventilated, who has been in hospital for about a week in the United States. She had a brain bleed, is diabetic, and has opened her eyes occasionally and is spiking the odd fever. I'm just a family friend. The patient has a brother who is a retired hospital pediatrician. I don't know if I should pass on your information to him, nor how I, as a non-medical professional, would present it in a way that wouldn't offend. Well, all I can say here is, you know, a pediatrician is not the expert in ICU unless they've worked in ICU. I'm not sure how you would offend someone to help them save their family member's life. I don't think that's offensive, right? So, you know, I mean, I've given enough examples here over the years, enough testimonials where family said, well, without your input that we shouldn't give up, you know, my family member would be dead now. And here they are, 10 months later, they're walking, they're talking, they're still alive. Even if they're not walking, they're not talking, they're still happy to be alive. Right? Always move the conversation away from end of life. Always. You know, always move away from those discussions, right? Don't let common sense dissuade you from doing what's right. Always use common sense to your advantage, if anything, you know. So I am going to wrap this up in a minute. You know, I do these live streams every week. 10:30 a.m. Sydney, Melbourne time, which is 8:30 p.m. on a Saturday night in the U.S. on the East Coast, Eastern Standard Time, 7:30 p.m. on a Saturday night, Central Time, 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time, 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time on a Saturday. So that's when I do these YouTube lives. And that's your opportunity to talk to me directly. Now, if you have a family member in intensive care, you know, and you need help urgently, you've come to the right place here. We help with consulting, advocacy, return, situation around. We've saved so many lives for families in intensive care over the years. We have a long-standing track record. Probably saved hundreds of lives over the years you know, you could be next, your family member can be next that we can save. And with intensive care at home, also have a look at intensivecareathome.com, where we send our critical care nurses into the home for long-term ventilation, tracheostomy, and where we can also help to save your family member's life there. And like I said, with intensive care at home, we're currently operating all around Australia for long-term ventilation, tracheostomy, tracheostomy without ventilation, BiPAP, CPAP ventilation without tracheostomy, home TPN, home BiPAP, home CPAP, cough assist management at home, central line management, PEEK line management, Higgins line management, as well as port management at home. And also ventilation weaning at home and also palliative care. We're also providing level 2 and level 3 NDIS support coordination. Now, I'll wrap this up here today. Thank you so much for watching. If you like the work that I'm doing here, like the video, subscribe to my YouTube channel, comment, and click the notification bell. And let me know what you want, what comment, let me know what content you want me to create, what questions you have, so that I can keep delivering on what you want. Take care for now. Have a good weekend.